Did you see, we've talked a lot about the new Luther movie that's coming out this Friday. Have you ever seen the original Luther movie? The classic, the one from 1953 in black and white. I have a childhood memory of seeing this film. It was a Sunday afternoon after church one day, a Lutheran church down there in Dallas, Texas. The screen was set up there at the front of the sanctuary, and the projector was brought out, and we watched the 1953 classic, the Luther movie. I have very vague memories of it because it was quite some time ago and I was rather little. Well, the new movie is out. This is the second treatment of Luther on the big screen. The first one very rapidly became a classic, been released on DVD. We're going to talk a bit about the original 1953 movie, Martin Luther, with Dr. Robert Lee. He joins us in just a moment. A little later in this hour, we'll have some open lines for your questions and your comments, some things I'd like to talk about. Well, let's just stay on the subject we've been on a little bit. Yesterday, it was Willow Creek and it was Bill Hybels. And let's return to this 40 Days of Purpose in the person of Rick Warren. He has written a column for the Baptist Press called First Person Stifled by Structure. We'll see what Rick Warren is recommending. You know, they're calling him America's pastor now. Rick Warren. We'll talk a bit about that during open lines in the second part of this hour. In the second hour, Dr. Paul Dieterding joins us. He's author of Our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for September, the Concordia Commentary on Colossians. We're going to cover some of the other subjects in Colossians, like sanctification, suffering with Christ, the Christian life, and vocation, all in the book of Colossians, in the second hour of Issues, Etc. And then in hour three, Uwe Simonetto, religion editor for United Press International, joins us. We'll get a religion roundup. We'll talk extensively about the Pope, about the clash of cultures with the Muslim world, and other things as well. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Joining us here in the first half hour to talk about the original 1953 movie, Martin Luther, Dr. Robert E.A. Lee. He spent 33 years as executive director of Lutheran Film Associates. He supervised the distribution of Martin Luther back in 1953 and served as a consultant to the new Luther movie. He's currently the director of Real World Communications and joins us from Baldwin, New York. Dr. Lee, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd. It's wonderful to be with you this afternoon.
Would you begin by giving us your fondest memory of the production of that classic 1953 movie, Martin Luther?
My fondest memory? Well, there are so many. But I suppose it's when I first saw the film, when it was screened in a screening room in New York, and it kind of took our breath away collectively. And I happened to be sitting near and talking afterwards to your own Dr. Ozzie Hoffman from St. Louis. And we were breathing a sigh of great relief, I think, because we'd put so much interest and so many prayers behind this endeavor, and then to have it work out what we thought was so well was really a big relief and an emotional memory for me.
What period of Luther's life did that original film cover?
Well, the original film covered, interestingly enough, Todd, it covered about the same era that the new one does. And there's a good reason for that, too. And it's a dramatic reason rather than a biographical historical reason. And that is that it started with his searching for a righteousness within the plan of God and his struggle to find it and his finding it. And then, of course, it went on through his very dramatic career up to the point where we had to have an ending. And the ending, which seemed to me the most satisfying, and of course to the scriptwriter and the director and all, was the result of the presentation of the Augsburg Confession, the Diet of Augsburg in 1530. That seemed to be the climax. And lo and behold, it's the climax of the new film as well.
You have seen the new film. You've served as a consultant to
yes,
the new Luther movie.
I just saw it recently, and I was so impressed with it, and I'm so gratified that I feel that it's not only a worthy successor to the original Martin Luther film, but it's fresh and new and different and exciting.
And it covers the same period of time, roughly, there.
Roughly, yes. Not necessarily the same scenes within that period of time, but you see, it started just at the turn of the century when Luther was just a young man and a university student. Actually, our film, the original one, started a little earlier, but this one starts with the fear from lightning, you know, that Luther once wrote that he was he made his decision to go into the monastery on the basis of his fear. Well, it started about then, and of course it went through all of the big scenes that did come, the 95 theses on the door of the church, the diet at Augsburg, and the diet of Worms, and then of course the new church, Luther's marriage, and the Augsburg Confession.
In 1953, were there the kind of concerns that exist for filmmakers today when they deal with a person of religious history like Martin Luther? There's the obvious concern that, you know, if you make it too religious, then it won't appeal to the broader audience. And I imagine there was probably even some who might have argued to leave the distinctly gospel elements out of the new Luther movie. Did those concerns exist in 1953?
Oh, perhaps even more so. Because no one had ever done this, really, in the sense of... I shouldn't say they wouldn't have religious films, because they've had a number of highly religious films and feature films in those days, but here was the very first attempt to bring out into the open the differences between the Roman Catholic tradition and the Protestant Lutheran tradition. And this inevitably made it necessary to talk about why was there a Reformation? And, of course, when that story was told, it was shocking. It was a revelation to a lot of people. It was controversial, and it was attacked. So all of those things were part of the climate, you might say, of receptivity back in 1953 when I ran the world premiere of Martin Luther in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area.
And how did it premiere? What obviously, movie theaters and the movie industry and the theater industry was a different animal in those days, but how did it premiere?
Well, no one would touch the film. That's why we had the kind of premiere we did. Because of the reasons I just mentioned, they were very skittish about the film industry, that is, was very skittish about putting this in theaters. And therefore, it was very difficult to get a distributor. And so it was decided on the board of Lutheran Film Associates, in that day it was called Lutheran Church Productions, that we should open the film ourselves and get an audience into theaters and demonstrate that it's an interesting film, get it reviewed, and see if it would go. And we did, and the theaters were packed. And the theater we opened with in Minneapolis was packed, literally packed, for 1 month entirely, where we had caravans of buses and cars coming from the upper Midwest to the theater to see this film. The churches supported it, you see, and the general public saw the lines, they read about it, and they came also. So as a result of that, it was off on a running start, and the word was buzzed through the entertainment industry that Luther was a box office winner, and therefore it really became one as a result of that reputation.
How many have seen the original Martin Luther movie since 1953, would you say?
Oh, boy. Yeah, it's your guess as well as mine, but we tried to count them out one time because we'd had it on television as well. And, you know, we don't know because there are an awful lot of people who were born and died within that 50-year period. So, and it was shown around the world. It was shown, 20th Century Fox at that point picked it up, because then when it was successful, we did have a distributor internationally, and they showed it around the world, so I couldn't even guess at the number of millions of people that have seen it.
Is it gratifying for you to see a wider distribution and debut of the new Luther movie this coming weekend?
Well, of course, because, and it deserves it, I might say, because it is... I think that it was so well done, and I like to think that our film back then gave it some impetus and some gave the creators of it confidence to go ahead and do it. And they got name actors, as you know, and they did it with a great ample budget. And, you know, we were doing it on a shoestring budget, actually. But nevertheless, it was done well. And for its time, our film was well received. You said you saw it yourself. And it was acclaimed by the critics and the public alike. It was attacked by those people who didn't like its premises.
Let's talk about Luther, the figure of history, as an apt subject for film. It's not often that, you know, every once in a while we'll have a literary figure from this period featured in a film today, but it's not often that an actual historical figure from 500 years ago is considered a viable subject for a movie.
Well, it isn't often that a man like Martin Luther comes along to permit that, because as people had said when they were talking about, you know, when we went into the 21st century, they were looking back into history as to who some of the more significant world changers in that period of time. And Martin Luther came up on practically every list, near the top. So that explains a little bit that he was a pivotal figure in history, and too strong and too forceful and too accomplished, I think, to be ignored on that level. And then, of course, there's the whole legacy that came from this, for good and evil. I mean, you know, it wasn't all a smooth ride, was it?
We're talking with Dr. Robert E. A. Lee. He spent 33 years as executive director of Lutheran Film Associates. He supervised the distribution of the original Martin Luther movie in 1953 and served as a consultant to the new Luther movie due to debut this coming Friday. He's currently the director of Real World Communications and joins us from Baldwin, New York. Dr. Lee, is there a need in your mind to reintroduce Luther and his theology as much as it can be in a film to this new generation of Americans and people worldwide?
Oh, I think this film speaks eloquently to that very point, Todd. Because I'm talking about the new film as well as the old, but particularly the new film, because it's a different audience today. It's a very sophisticated, visually oriented audience. I mean, they've grown up with television, for goodness sakes, and that changes the way people perceive the information they get. And so this film is tailored to reach this generation, but it also is tailored to reach the needs of this generation, because one thing about this new film that I found so satisfying, so gratifying, was that the real gospel of Jesus Christ came out in it. And to find that on the screen these days is indeed rare. But it was done, you see, with such an embedded belonging to the story that it was perfectly understandable, legitimate. It didn't seem like it was added on at all. It just grew out of the conflicts that Luther as a person had, and that the people, as fearful and almost in spiritual slavery in that era, had. So I think that when people today are confused and they're fearful and they're anxious about so many things in a way today that's different from certainly the 16th century, but still very profound, this film still brings its message of the fact that there is faith in Jesus Christ, which is the answer to people's needs. And I believe it's played out in a very dramatic and forceful and convincing way by the excellent actors, the wonderful script, and the great direction of the new Luther film.
Folks, if you have a question, a comment, or a story to tell about what you remember from the 1953 movie Martin Luther, give us a call now, 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. We're talking with the original distributor of the Martin Luther movie, as well as a consultant to the new Luther movie, Dr. Robert E. A. Lee. Dr. Lee,
you can call me Bob, please.
Okay, Bob. How was the original 1953 movie developed? Was it from a book or a screenplay?
No, it was written by Alan Sloan. Alan Sloan was a successful screenwriter who had done some work for the churches, actually, and they made an impression. So he was asked to do research on this, and he had lots of help, of course, because we had Lutheran theologians by the dozens, and historians, and biographers, who were willing to lend their talents as well. And so he put together this whole concept. The first draft of the script, by the way, that he came up with, had a lot of merit, but it was a little bit too eloquent, too Shakespearean, too much. and so this had to be leaned out, and we had a very wise producer, Lothar Wolff, who had been born and raised in Germany and came over to this country and was knowledgeable in German and in English so well. And he had been schooled in the art of editing film. And so he, with his help, we were able to pare it down and to make it into a very moving and kind of liquid screenplay. And then to make sure that the elements in the film, the scenes, were as authentic as possible, not that it was all exactly historically 100% accurate, because they had to have dramatic license in order to make this a story that would could be dramatized. But in order to check it out, we had some excellent scholars. Yaroslav Pelikan, who had been a Luther scholar, and Theodor Tappert, who was another Luther scholar, were collaborating with the screenwriter and the producer and the board to make it the kind of script that everybody could live with and be proud of.
You said the movie was produced on a shoestring budget, especially in comparison to how movies are produced today. How long did it take to end the principal photography, the shooting, for the original Luther movie?
Well, it took, I would say, about 3 months of actual shooting. A lot of preparation for that, of course, and a lot of post-production work on it and editing. But the actual on-location and studio shooting was contained within about 3 months, and it was all done over in Germany. And at that time, you see, it was actually shot in 1952, it was two countries. Germany was two countries, and we were not allowed into East Germany to shoot. And of course, East Germany is where all the Luther places are. So they had to be duplicated in West Germany, in studios in Wiesbaden, but in other locations that were similar and retained their kind of medieval look. Actually, we were able to borrow footage, or not borrow, but buy footage of Wartburg Castle, for example. So that was actually the Wartburg Castle in the first Luther film. But the scenes, like in Worms and other places like that, were reproduced as accurately as possible by good set designers and staging people and all.
How were the actors chosen, and especially the actor that portrayed Luther himself?
In the first film?
Yes.
Well, there was a casting director, a casting person who was in England, because the decision was made rather early on that the film had to be understood by American audiences primarily. Obviously, it was later translated into many languages. So we needed to have people speaking English who could be understood in the United States rather than come with perhaps a heavy German accent, even though that often is done, and there were some of that. There was some of that in our original film, but the English speaking, we decided on having British rather than American actors because we didn't want a Clark Gable or somebody who was immediately familiar to an American audience. It had to be somebody who was a good, solid actor, who was not necessarily a household name in the United States. And then once we chose, through auditions, Niall McGuinness, who is actually an Irish actor who is a medical doctor as well as an actor, he sold us on his ability to do the part. And the dialogue coach who was working on this was working with him to cultivate what they used to call a mid-Atlantic accent, not heavily British and not American jargon, but mid-Atlantic. And I think it worked.
And his depiction, this actor's depiction of the internal spiritual struggle that so marked this period of Luther's life, your assessment of that?
Say that again, please.
The internal spiritual struggle that so marked Luther's life, how did that actor in the 1953 film bring that across on film?
Well, like any good actor does, you know, they have to understand it, and they have to internalize it, and they have to inhabit the role. And some actors can do that better than other actors. And these actors were very good at it. They had to feel it. And, of course, there were lots of persons around that could help if they had some questions. And there were a lot of questions, obviously, of, you know, what does this mean? What does that mean? Because these were kind of technical, doctrinal terms in many cases, and they had to be simplified for an audience. And so they were able to do that with that in mind. And the director had to understand this. The director had to appreciate what the real values of Christianity were.
Finally, Bob, the 1953 movie became a classic not only because of its subject, of course, but also because of of the quality of the film. It was a good film. It was a classic film. It is such a cliche now to see Christian films with Christian subjects with kind of poor production values. Mm. Why does that irritate you as a filmmaker and a distributor as well?
Oh, of course it does, because not only was I with the Luther film, but I also have produced others myself, and I have been a film reviewer. And so as a result of that, at one point in my career, I saw a film every week and wrote a review every week about a new film. And so I believe that I've come around, both by my production work as well as my reviewing work, to kind of smell when something is phony or it's overdone or it's what we used to call quiche. So when there's the real thing, I think that not only do I know, but the audience knows it, you know. And whether they can articulate that or not, if they feel it, and I certainly felt it in the new film, even as, of course, I did in the old one.
We're talking with Dr. Robert E. A. Lee about the original 1953 movie. Dr. Lee, I'd like you to stay with us for a few moments
after
the break to take some phone calls.
Sure.
When we come back, we will take your phone calls. The break is a great time to call with a question, a comment, or a memory of seeing the 1953 original movie, Martin Luther. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. A few minutes after this break, we'll be joined by Dr. Paul Dieterding, author of our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for September, the Concordia Commentary on Colossians. We'll spend some time talking with him about sanctification, suffering with Christ, the Christian life and vocation, all in the book of Colossians. Then, in the last hour of the program, we'll be talking with Uwe Simonetto. He's religion editor for United Press International. We'll get a religion roundup. We'll take your phone calls after this.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
If the book of Romans is Paul's treatise on justification by grace through faith, then the book of Colossians is Paul's treatise on Christ. What does Paul teach in the book of Colossians on the person and work of Jesus Christ? Our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for September, is the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Colossians by Dr. Paul Dieterding. The book costs $39.99 plus shipping and handling. You can order by calling Concordia Publishing House at 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or go online at issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on the book. 1-800-325-3040, issuesetc.org. When you call or write, ask for the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for September.
Now, Now this Global Minute focuses on children in Brazil who have no family, but who are finding hope through Jesus Christ. Street children are a common sight in many countries around the world, including Brazil. But the Rainbows of Hope is one of the ministries offering boys and girls in Brazil the chance to hear about Christ, learn the Bible, and get motivated to attend school. Bible clubs offer neighborhood kids the chance to gather with each other and get prayer. In addition, a boys' home and girls' home provides a safe place to grow in a family-like setting. Rainbows of Hope wants churches around the globe to get actively involved in some form of ministry to hurting children, including boys and girls who are used as child soldiers or exploited as child laborers. Pray for street children in Brazil to hear about Christ and grow in Him. Get information for prayer on issues like this by logging onto the website missionvisionnetwork.org. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Along a walking path around Lake Harriet in Minneapolis, you can see a little 6-inch door at the base of a hollowed-out ash tree. That's the home of Mr. Little Guy, an elf who took up residence there 8 years ago. A path has been beaten to the door by children who bring letters to Mr. Little Guy, 1,500 of them a year, and every one gets answered. AP reporter Greg Amott interviewed Mr. Little Guy, a 51-year-old family man who remains anonymous. He said, "I don't think that all kids think they have somebody in their corner. So Mr. Little Guy is just a guy that's in their corner." Every letter finishes with, "I believe in you." Now compare Mr. Little Guy's attitude to this quotation from the September issue of Glamour magazine. Michaela wrote, "Deciding to have the abortion was a huge eye-opener. This may sound strange, but I felt I knew the being I was carrying. I felt he was my son. I even called him Ernesto. And Ernesto was my reminder that my life was significant and that having an abortion was putting my life first." Think about that.
You know, evolutionists have some crazy ideas, Paul. They believe that given enough time, almost anything can happen. For example, give 10,000 monkeys 10,000 typewriters and wait a million years, and you might even get the works of William Shakespeare.
Hey, say at that rate, they ought to be able to do an episode of Wrestling with the Basics in 5 minutes.
Two men doing the work of 10,000 monkeys.
Wrestling with the Basics, Saturday mornings at 9:05 on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking about the original 1953 movie Martin Luther. Of course, the occasion is the upcoming debut of the new Luther movie this coming Friday. Our guest, Dr. Robert E. A. Lee, if you'd like to share a memory of seeing that 1953 classic, or if you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Willis is calling from Perryville. Willis, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hello there, Todd. Yeah, Dr. Lee is very much correct. The movie was well-received and many millions of people saw it. In fact, I was stationed in not too far from Berkeley, California, up a mountain about 4 miles from the city. And so in the church bulletin, they had a University of Lutheran Chapel there. They had a little deal, church reduction ticket. So me and another fellow went to the deal, and the guy was so impressed when he saw Luther defending his teaching at the Diet of Worms. This fellow said, "Will Luther live through it?" I said, "Oh, yeah, he'll survive it." It was a very well-received movie throughout the United States, and that was way back in, it must have been about this time of the year, so I saw it there near Berkeley, California.
Willis, thank you very much for calling in. Dr. Lee, your reaction?
Well, I was so pleased to hear from Willis and to recognize a couple of things in what he said that I also resonated to. One is those reduction coupons that he talked about, the tickets, and we used those to great advantage through the churches so that if they had a ticket that they got from their local church, they could then go to the theater and get a discount on the price. And it was a reminder, not just the discount, but the fact that they had in their hand a little, you might say, a flyer about the film, reminded them to come and see it. And then, of course, when he mentioned the scene of the Diet of Worms, everybody, I think, agrees that that was probably the most powerful dramatic moment in the film, when he states his faith that, here I stand, I can do no other, God help me.
I think that's part of the genius of telling this story. If you leave, if you were to try and fit all of Luther's life into a single film, of course, it would be a monumental task. You wouldn't be able to do it in 4 hours of film. You would overwhelm the modern audience. But by leaving it there at kind of one of the apexes of his early career, it leaves the film goer, the person who's perhaps only has a cursory understanding of Luther or his theology, with all the kinds of questions you want them to be asking about this man who brought to light the gospel that had been obscured.
Indeed, and you know that the essence, it seems to me, of our dealing with the matters of faith, and faith being something that we can't see but have to appreciate and feel otherwise, means that we have to start asking questions. And of course, when they see the life of Luther, where he was up against tremendous odds and decided that in spite of throwing in the towel, which he could have done many times, he stood up to his adversaries, and he was stronger for it, and he also then became an example for millions of others.
The 1953 film was, in 1954, nominated for 2 Academy Awards. What for?
Yes, it was nominated for their set design and also for the costuming. Set design, I should call it art direction, overall art direction and set design. And the fact that it was nominated, of course, because there were only a half a dozen or so in each category, made it special for us. And while it would have been nice to have gotten the Oscar, that wasn't the main thing that we were after, but at least it got some public recognition within the film industry, and even that was a pioneering act back in those days.
It must have been, again, gratifying after having such a difficult time finding a distributor or getting the movie into film houses to have this recognition from the film industry.
Oh, sure, and it happened to me once again with our film that we had made for public television called A Time for Burning, which was about the racial tension situation in the United States in the 60s, that was nominated for an Academy Award. So I know the feeling and I know the value.
Let's talk with Jeff, who's calling from his car. Jeff, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hello, Todd. How are you?
Very well.
Very good. Hey, listen, the reason I was calling is with everything going on now in Roman Catholicism about maybe taking the wine away from the laity, I wondered if the movie, the old movie or the previous movie, may touch on that in its content.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Your answer to that question, Dr. Lee?
Well, I'm not sure I can answer it, because it deals with it in the sense that it does include, of course, the major scene where Luther, for the first time, was celebrating the Mass, and then it also deals with the fact that the communion elements under both signs are for the overall people. It doesn't dwell on it particularly in any, doesn't make a big scene out of it or make a big issue out of it, but it's there as a part of the whole kind of idea of what it means to be Protestant in the world, rather than being subservient to the hierarchy and feeling that the church was really the clergy.
How was the 53 Martin Luther film received by Roman Catholic viewers, and how do you think the new one will be received?
Well, I don't know how the new one will be received, but I'm trusting that it will be received well, because I think that even the way it was made is perhaps, if I may say so, a little more ironic than the original one was, in that while it still is hard-hitting, the role of Tetzel was very hard-hitting in this new film, as it was in the old film. But somehow, back then, it engendered a good deal of surprise and was counteracted by a lot of people, not all. And Roman Catholic Church changed its attitude about the film because, after all, we've been showing this for 50 years. And then it came to the point where it was being used in Catholic seminaries and Catholic schools even, which we'd never dreamed of back in the old days when some of the bishops called us communists for exposing the Roman Catholic Church's errors.
When was the last time, Dr. Lee, that you watched the 1953 film Martin Luther?
I've watched it hundreds of times, Todd, and probably the last time was when I checked over the new DVD we made. I produced for Lutheran Film Associates, even though I'm a retired person now but a consultant. I produced the DVD version of it. That is, we transferred it to DVD, and within that DVD, we have a story of the biography of a film where we kind of trace how it was made, what happened to it, and that sort of thing. And, of course, I checked every scene of it at the time so that I was sure it could be released safely.
That's one of my favorite things about watching films on DVD is all the little extras that they put in there that give us a picture into how the director was thinking or what the actors were doing or how the film was put together. I look forward to seeing it. Dr. Robert E.A. Lee, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
It's been my pleasure. Good to talk with you, Todd.
Folks, he mentions this re-release of the 1953 classic Martin Luther on DVD. You can purchase the DVD or the video by calling Vision Video at 1-800-523-0226. That's 1-800-523-0226, or you can order them online at realworldcom.com. Now that's spelled realworldcom.com, realworldcom.com. Dr. Robert E.A. Lee spent 33 years as executive director for Lutheran Film Associates. He supervised the distribution of the Martin Luther film back in 1953 and served as a consultant to the new Luther movie. He's currently director of Real World Communications and joined us from Baldwin, New York. Now, we will be having the special screening for AM 850 KFUO listeners of the new Luther film this coming Saturday at 10 o'clock at the DePere 14 Cinema at 270 in Manchester. We filled up a small theater, and then we went to a larger theater and filled that one up. The tickets are no longer available, unfortunately. I do want to speak one word of caution that's kind of come to our attention for families with young children who are planning on attending. We want you to attend, but we want you to understand that the new Luther film does receive a PG-13 rating, and there's a reason for that. In fact, there are four reasons for that, and I think that the parents who are planning on attending our private screening for AM 850 KFUO listeners ought to be aware of these things before they go in. The reason that it is receiving not a PG but a PG-13 rating is fourfold. First of all, it does depict in historical accuracy war violence, not flowing blood and gore, but actual war action. That's part and parcel of the story of Luther. These were times, very tumultuous times, in Northern Europe. Also, there is at least one occasion in the film where Luther, during the course of a spiritual struggle, does use a vulgarity when addressing the devil. This is also a matter of historical accuracy. It is not gratuitous. All right? Then another reason that this movie receives a PG-13 rating and parents with small children or young children should be aware going in, there are some very quick scenes of 16th century woodcuts depicting kind of the polemic against Roman Catholicism. And some of them, in the manner of that day, are intended to be kind of graphically vulgar. It does not dwell upon it, and it's shown very quickly. This is another common thing from Luther's day, kind of the satire of one another during the time of the Reformation between Lutherans and Roman Catholics. And finally, the movie receives a PG-13 rating because it is an intense drama. In the words of one person who has reviewed it, it is not a Disney romp through the park. It is a serious film. So we want your expectations to be accurate here going into the Luther film. It is in every sense a modern film. It is not a vulgar or gross film, but it does receive a PG-13 rating. and we thought the parents who were coming to our private screening or planning to see the movie at a different time ought to be aware of that. We're going to spend the rest of this hour talking with the author of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, Dr. Paul Dieterding. He's joined us several times in the course of this month, and we've been walking through the high points of the book of Colossians, because our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September is the Concordia Commentary on Colossians. We've talked about the Christology, the teachings on salvation in Colossians. We've talked about the nature of the church in Colossians. During this hour, lapping over into hour two, we'll be talking with Dr. Dieterding about the subjects of sanctification, suffering with Christ, the Christian life and vocation in the book of Colossians. Open your Bibles to that New Testament book as we prepare to talk with Dr. Paul Dieterding. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment on the book of Colossians, this is a great time to do it. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Paul Dieterding is pastor of Bethlehem Lutheran Church in Carson City, Nevada. He's author of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, the Concordia Commentary on Colossians. I'll tell you a little bit more about that later. Dr. Dieterding, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Good to be with you again, Todd.
Let's begin jumping right in to the subject of sanctification. That is a term that in and of itself requires a bit of definition. Before we get into Paul's view in Colossians, define the term, please.
The word, breaking it down to its grammatical meaning, has to do with making holy. Now, having said that, we have to define that right away. Sometimes the Bible uses words, terms in that word group to sanctify in terms of the Christian standing before God, that through faith in Jesus Christ, he is forgiven of all his wrong, his unholiness, if you will, and therefore his status before God now is one of holiness because of Christ. And so the New Testament sometimes talks about being sanctified with that kind of meaning. Usually when we use the word sanctification, and the way I think we're going to be thinking of that this afternoon, has to do then with the Christian life that follows, that having been brought to faith in Jesus Christ, having one's sins forgiven, being in a status before God of holiness and righteousness, how, therefore, will this individual live? And how he will live, instruction for how he will live, encouragement to live in that way, the life that he brings forward, that's usually what we mean when we're talking about the term sanctification.
A point that's been made several times in the course of our conversation on the book of Colossians, and I'd like you to explore it one more time for our listeners, and that is that Paul's teaching on sanctification isn't like, well, first I'm going to talk about Christ, and then I'm going to go on to a completely different subject and talk about the Christian life. These two, Paul makes a very strong connection between the specific things he teaches of Christ in the book of Colossians and the things he teaches of the Christian. Explain that to us.
Okay. Colossians can be sort of broadly divided into two parts. The first two chapters dealing with the teaching about Christ, about the way of salvation, and related themes. And then starting with chapter 3, then he turns more to the Christian life. But as you indicated, there are definite connections between the two. The material of the latter two chapters are very definitely built upon the material of the first two chapters. Chapter 3, which I indicated is where the topic of sanctification as we've defined it is taken up in Colossians. It begins, and here I'm reading from the English Standard Version, "If then you have been raised with Christ." Well, that's language that recalls what's been said in the previous section. It takes us back to 2:12, which is a very foundational verse in the entire letter, where Paul writes that his readers have been buried with Christ in baptism and then raised from the dead with him. And so that idea of being buried and raised with Christ in baptism, and of course being buried and raised implies having died, is continued on in that section, moving down in chapter 2, verse 20, "If with Christ you died to the elemental spirits of the world, and that will again recall what's been said earlier, that their burial and resurrection with Christ in baptism implies also their death with him in baptism. So that leads up then till we get to 3:1, when he starts then, if you have been raised with Christ, which I've said just shortly before this, yes, indeed, you have been raised with Christ. Now, therefore, here are some consequences that flow from that, and some of them are depicted, are presented precisely in this kind of language, that you've been raised with Christ, so and put to death with Christ, and so therefore that's going to affect your life. So he'll say things like 3:1, seek the things that are above. 3:2, set your minds on the things that are above. 3:5, put to death. And then building on that, the put to death, and then put off. 3:8, you must put them all off. And 3:10, he talks about having put on. 3:12 comes another imperative, put on then. 3:14, above these, put on love. So his exhortations to how they should live are based upon, built upon, his instruction that he has given earlier in the letter as to what Christ has done for them.
Now, there's so much here. We should just point out at this juncture that what we're really arguing for here is reading all of this book, Colossians, and really, for that matter, any other epistle of Paul or any other book of the Bible in its context.
Yeah, that's a good point. We're perhaps used to from our own worship practice on a Sunday or other occasion for worship that there will be perhaps three appointed lessons and a portion of an epistle, for example, or a gospel or an Old Testament book will be read. And even if it's a fairly long one, maybe it's 15, 20 verses, occasionally even longer, it will be an excerpt of that. We need to always remember that these are portions from a complete work, and that just as a gospel or a collection of a prophet's works are intended to be understood as a whole, their message is to be read as a whole. So especially the letters of Paul, for example, written to a particular congregation, written to groups of Christians, written in some cases to individuals, they have their impact as a whole. And while we may be focusing in a worship service or a Bible class or any other time on a portion of that, we need to always remember that it was intended to have its impact, its message, as a part of the whole letter that was written.
Beginning at chapter 3, and you've made mention of this, but the wording intrigues me. Paul writes, therefore, put to death your members which are on earth. And then he goes into a list of sins, fornication, uncleanness, passion, wicked desire, covetousness, which is idolatry. On account of these things, the anger of God is coming upon the sons of unbelief. What does Paul mean by the word put to death? And why does he say put to death your members? That just seems like odd choice of words.
Put to death, as we've indicated, recalls what he said before, what's already taken place in their baptism. And so it's an example here of what is sometimes termed the Bible's practice of exhorting us to Christian living by telling us to be what we already are. What you already are in baptism, put to death with Christ. Now put that into practice in how you live. So put to death, in this instance, all these vices that he lists here. The term members, which you point to, is used here, shall we say, as a synonym of the word body. Put to death the members of your body. Paul sometimes speaks of the body of a person, of a body of people, as a designation for the individual. When Paul uses terms like body, flesh, spirit, soul, these are not intended to be pieces that when you add them all together, you get a person. But rather, they're different ways of talking about a person's existence. The word body emphasizes one's physical makeup as a creature of God. Members here serves as a sort of synonym of that, filling in for the word body. And the language here emphasizes the fact that our being has become corrupted by our sinfulness. The fact that we are not perfect before God, the fact that we are sinful, corrupts our whole being. And so he's saying, put that all to death. There isn't a part of you that's reserved for yourself or reserved for evil or reserved for Satan or anything else like that. But your whole being, insofar as it's become corrupted by evil, put it to death. And then he spells that out by saying, put to death, get away from, stop doing such vices as here I'm giving some examples.
It seems, with only about a minute here before the break, it seems as though Paul, while mentioning what most people consider to be kind of sinful acts, does emphasize there in chapter 3 when he's telling people to put off and put to death certain things, more or less what we would call desires or thoughts or emotions rather than acts as he does elsewhere.
Yeah, here in this part of chapter 3, there's a couple of places where he lists some things as examples, and they tend to sort of cover the range to give the understanding that it's all that is sinful. It's not just certain acts, not just words, but even thoughts, even feelings, that all that's become corrupted by sin and wickedness, put it off, put to death, stop doing it, put away, bring forth the new kind of life now for which Christ has redeemed you.
Dr. Paul Dieterding is our guest. He's author of Our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for September, the Concordia Commentary on Colossians. We're looking at the book of Colossians, in particular with an eye toward the teaching of Paul there regarding sanctification. We'll move on a little later to suffering with Christ, the Christian life and vocation, all in the book of Colossians. If you have a question or a comment as we talk about sanctification in the book of Colossians, give us a call, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. This conversation with Dr. Dieterding continues after this top of the hour break into the next hour, and then we'll be joined by Uwe Simonetto. We'll get a religion roundup with him there near the end of the second hour of Issues, Etc. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. This conversation on Colossians continues after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.